Hello and welcome to the Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. I'm Maria Armudian. In this hour, Peru has faced ongoing protests and violence since the removal of its president at the hands of the Congress. What socioeconomic divisions in the nation have led to this deepened political crisis? And first, the island of Puerto Rico has a complex relationship with the federal government of the United States. Should it seek statehood or independence? Or is the status quo the best option for the nation? Doug Becker explores.
I'm Doug Becker. American diplomatic historians often describe the U.S. as exceptional because of its decision not to take colonies like so many European countries did. But this is not actually accurate. The U.S. does have a status as an empire because it does have colonies, and many of which do remain part of the empire. Perhaps the most visible and most salient is the island of Puerto Rico. Its relationship with the U.S. federal government is complex. On today's show, we will explore this relationship with an eye towards the potential for altering its current status with either statehood in the U.S. or independence from the nation. Our panel today is Amilcar Antonio Barreto. He's professor and chair of Cultures, Societies, and Global Studies, as well as interim director of and professor of International Affairs and Political Science at Northeastern University. He's the author of American Identity, Congress, and the Puerto Rico Statehood Debate, and The Politics of Language in Puerto Rico Revisited. And Jorge Farinacci Fernos is associate professor of law at the Inter-American University of Puerto Rico Law School, and is currently a visiting professor at the University of Buffalo School of Law. He's the author of The New Insular Cases and the Territorial Clause, From Temporary Incorporation to Permanent Unincorporation, and a forthcoming book, Puerto Rico's Constitutional Paradox, Colonial Subordination, Democratic Tension, and the Promise of Progressive Transformation. Thank you both very much for joining us. Puerto Rico grabbed a lot of headlines as a result of the hurricane that hit a few years ago. And frequently, we always heard descriptions, you know, should the U.S. help Puerto Rico? And reminders that Puerto Rico is a part of the United States. But that's really kind of a complex question. Jorge Farinacci Fernos, what exactly is Puerto Rico's status in the United States?
Well, actually, we have to start with something you just said. The current U.S. law is that we belong to, but are not a part of, the United States. And I am not quoting some, you know, pamphlet on the street. I'm quoting a U.S. Supreme Court decision in the phraseology I just used. So obviously, that question has both legal and political implications, right? In terms of the U.S. domestic constitutional parlance, we are a territory of the United States. As we know, in the U.S., either you're a state, you have federal enclaves, right? And the District of Columbia has its own constitutional particularity as a space. And you have the Native American tribes, and then you have territories. So the short answer of what is Puerto Rico under U.S. domestic law is a territory. Now, eventually, we need to get into these important distinctions between an unincorporated territory and an incorporated territory. But the main concept is a territory. But politically, what is that? Well, we're talking about a territory, a physical space full of people. with political organization, an economic structure, a culture, a functioning society that does not completely govern itself and does not have either the ultimate word in its own affairs or have any participation in the spaces where those ultimate decisions are made. And to me, from a non-legal standpoint, that's called colonialism. So the distinction between a colonial status and the form of territorial accommodation that Puerto Rico has, particularly in recent times, because for many decades we were given considerable autonomy that one would think that the leash was gone because we had such slack But now with the PROMESA statute and the fiscal control board, we're back to early 20th century, more direct form of political control by non-elected entities. So what the main thing that this tells us is that colonialism is constitutionally valid under US constitutional law. So short slash long answer, Puerto Rico is a quote unquote self-governing territory of the United States, but the self-governing part has taken a tremendous hit in recent times. And now, for example, the decisions of our elected legislature and elected governor are subject to veto by an unelected board appointed by federal officers. So that's the situation right now, in that we belong to, but are not part of the United States. But at the same time, the people who live here, because one of the things about US federalism is that one question is, where do you live? Second question is, who are you? So that's the status of Puerto Rico. The status of Puerto Ricans is a separate issue. It just happens that many Puerto Ricans live in Puerto Rico. But we are, when we are born, we're granted US citizenship. And so, for example, if I ever decide to move to the United States and wait a year, I can now pay my taxes as everybody. I can vote in presidential elections as anybody. But so that's the difficulty of pinpointing the exact situation, because it depends on the status of the Puerto Rican territory and the situation of Puerto Ricans in general as well.
And Amilcar Antonio Barreto, Jorge kind of anticipated my next question. First question, is Puerto Rico a part of the U.S.? Next question, are Puerto Ricans Americans? Both, there's the legal question and then there's the broad sort of political identity question.
This is not unique to U.S.-Puerto Rico relations. In most countries around the world, there's a difference between bare minimum statutory citizenship and full citizenship, which pertains to the dominant group in that particular society. I can go from one country to another and find minorities. Yes, you have citizenship. That's the bare minimum. Unfortunately, in the early 20th century, zeal among the Puerto Rican political elite to attain U.S. citizenship, they really ignored the fact that the citizenship they got was not that different quality-wise from the citizenship of African Americans at the same time. U.S. citizens, but what it meant was, we can draft you, send you to war, and don't you ask for too many rights. We have a system called Jim Crow to put you back in your place. Many other peoples have experienced something similar. Let's just say that Puerto Ricans who live on the U.S. mainland often feel a social kind of colonialism that is detached from Puerto Rico, the island of Puerto Rico's political status, but it's absolutely attached to Puerto Rico's social status in the eyes of the U.S.
And to follow that up, Amilcar, I know there's this large presence of Puerto Ricans living in the United States, particularly on the East Coast, has at least raised the profile of this question about, are Puerto Ricans Americans and Puerto Rico as a political issue? I don't know if it's proper to call them the expat community, because are they exactly Puerto Rican expatriates or whatever from a legal perspective? But how much is this presence of people of Puerto Rican descent living in the United States helping to affect, to alter, to frame some of the political discourses about Puerto Rico's future with the U.S.?
Well, it's amazing if you look at the long view. If I look at the past half century ago, whenever the federal government was looking to find out how do we deal with the Puerto Ricans who live here, they looked to the island of Puerto Rico, Puerto Rico's elected officials, and Puerto Rico's delegate, the resident commissioner, to the House of Representatives. They looked towards the island. Fast forward, at this juncture, close to two-thirds of all ethnic Puerto Ricans live on the U.S. mainland. Two-thirds. Consequently, there are now several Puerto Ricans elected in the House of Representatives. The battle has shifted. Uncle Sam doesn't necessarily go first to the island of Puerto Rico to ask, what do you guys want? Sometimes they're going to listen first to members of Congress who don't necessarily agree with one another, but they have a vote, a voice and a vote versus the resident commissioner. The tide has turned.
Now, Jorge, I know This came up quite a bit with the needs for reconstruction following the hurricane, I believe it was 2017, that Puerto Rico has had these financial crises and was hoping to secure loans, to secure funding to help to provide some of these resources. Turned out they really didn't have, the government in Puerto Rico really didn't have very much latitude to be able to negotiate these terms. So therefore, they kind of get in the worst of both worlds, where they're not treated as an independent state, so they can't raise financing. And then if the U.S. isn't, the federal government isn't providing the financing, that they just end up having projects that can't get completed because they can't come up with money for it.
So very quickly, I need to reply to the previous question. It's a very tough existential question. Are Puerto Ricans Americans? And I think the answer that will be depends on who you ask. Even us, it's an identity question. I don't consider myself an American. Some do, and I don't think they're particularly wrong, right? It's not, we tend to excommunicate people who have, no, that some people genuinely believe they are. I am not a Canadian, nothing against Canada. I'm not a Spaniard, nothing against Spain. I'm not an American, nothing against the U.S. And that is part of the of that existential question. And many of us, myself included, when we go to the States, I feel sort of, emphasis on sort of, but in general, an immigrant experience. I notice when I go to the U.S. that I am an outsider. I feel it. And not necessarily even in a bad way. It's just that I noticed those this distinction. Even again, how do we characterize this the Puerto Ricans who've left? We call it the diaspora sometimes, right? It's this idea of that, yeah, they're over there, they're still part of our cultural community, but there is now a physical distance, etc. Now, with regard to your next question, one of the things about colonialism is that colonialism is not just a political project. It has economic implications in terms of the ability. So it's, again, it's a vicious cycle because colonialism tends to destroy self-sustained economic structures. And therefore, you need the metropolitan power to interfere constantly. And that means, oh, that therefore you can't, you know, function correctly. And the cycle continues. And that sort of limbo, I can give you another example. So when we were on the brink of bankruptcy, the government wanted to literally file for bankruptcy, but we had been excluded from the federal bankruptcy code in the 1980s. So that we figured, okay, so we'll pass a local law, a local statute that would allow us to file for bankruptcy, because if we're not included in the protections of the federal bankruptcy code, therefore we are free to do our own bankruptcy. And the Supreme Court said, no, you're outside of the code for purposes of its protections, but inside the code for purposes of preemption. So we were literally, we couldn't get the federal protections and we couldn't pass a state law. It was the worst of both worlds. I think Justice Ginsburg called it a never, never land, something like that. So that repeats itself. For example, when we had the natural disasters, we had other countries who wanted to bring their ships in with aid, but they couldn't come in because the Jones Act doesn't allow it. So, but we were also not getting the American ships. So it was this again, this limbo that doesn't give us the ability to fully maximize the options that will be available maybe to a state or to an independent nation.
And Amilcar, I know one of the huge concerns, you know, with Puerto Rico was just simply the mismanagement of the response in 2017, both the immediate response, you know, to the hurricane, and then certainly the more medium term rebuilding, you know, helping to reconstruct the island. I think it's pretty fair to say that on the island, they're pretty dissatisfied with the nature of that response. How much is that driving, you know, then a demand that, I mean, we have to change the current status because being between statehood and independence just sort of leaves you on the periphery, as Jorge has been describing.
Let me share an anecdote. My step-grandfather, who was a huge activist in the Puerto Rican statehood movement, he was a veteran of World War I, and he would love to say, America is great because America is good. And this is a man who lived through what I've described in one of my writings. He lived through Puerto Rico's golden half century. Basically, from the eve of World War II until the end of the Cold War, Uncle Sam cared about Puerto Rico for its own purposes, using it as a military base and a quote-unquote showcase for democracy. After the Cold War, federal government lost interest in Puerto Rico, and we could see that right away when the federal government killed Section 936 of the federal tax code. That was the economic lifeline of the Puerto Rican economy, and it didn't replace it. And soon thereafter, the economic downturn continued. I'll say anecdotally, from the perspective of the Puerto Rican who lives on the U.S. mainland and occasionally goes back to the island, my first time back to the island after Hurricane Maria, I had a sense of collective melancholy, which I had never seen before. Again, anecdotally, among many of my relatives, the assumption that we would never be abandoned by Uncle Sam, and they see, oh, yes, you can be abandoned by Uncle Sam. It's a realization that what they thought was the nature of federal territorial relations was based on that golden half century, not realizing it's over.
You're listening to Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. I'm Doug Becker. We're discussing the current status of Puerto Rico vis-a-vis the U.S. federal government and potential alterations of that status with Amilcar Antonio Barreto of Northeastern University and Jorge Farinacci Fernos of the Inter-American University of Puerto Rico Law School, also visiting at the University of Buffalo. So, Jorge, I guess the next question is, if the current status isn't terribly attractive to Puerto Ricans, and I think it's fair to say where it currently is doesn't necessarily work, is the better pathway to seek closer ties with the U.S. statehood, or maybe it's time to grant Puerto Rico its independence? So if it's a colony, globally, colonies are supposed to be granted their independence by now.
Yeah, colonialism is illegal. And normally the solution for colonialism is self-determination and liberation, of being rid of the colonial relationship and therefore a break with the metropolitan power. Now, the problem is that the issue of statehood is a controversial one, not only in the United States, which it is. It's a controversial position in Puerto Rico to have. We are split down the middle as to that question. Now, for many years, what happened, technically for decades, no one really defended the territorial status, because those who defended the status quo would argue that the territorial condition had been overcome in 1952 with the adoption of the Commonwealth status. So therefore, they didn't have to say, yes, we support the territorial status, because they were saying, no, we are no longer that. Recent U.S. Supreme Court decisions, which many have dubbed the new insular cases, have said, no. Nothing really happened in 52. We gave you the keys to the car, but not the title to the car. So it was some more self-government, but no actual fundamental change in the territorial status. Now, the problem is that after 57 years of, you know, it's sort of a dysfunctional functional colonialism, right? It is a dysfunctional system, but we people have been able to raise their children and you know, have a decent life. So therefore, there are vested interests in the current status, not only in Puerto Rico, but in the U.S. as well, particularly economic interests. Because, for example, what happened right now with the Fiscal Control Board, you can't do that to a U.S. state. And unless you want to send in the Marines, you can't do that to an independent republic. So the best, actually, this became the panacea for the vulture funds, et cetera, who bought up much of Puerto Rican debt, because they have the political tools to keep us in check because we are a territory of the United States. Now, the problem is that independence is not a majoritarian position either. And there has been some attempts to define some sort of independence that has maybe under the treaty clause in terms of U.S. constitutional law, that would have some sort of understanding one-on-one with the U.S., particularly with regards of things like citizenship and defense and the fiscal and trade, which are, again, we've been, even though we belong to but are not part of the United States, our economy is completely integrated to the United States economy. So just granting Puerto Rico independence and here the keys to the car after you've broken down the car, it's a problem. So even then it would have to be a transition. And there's understandable fear of both positions. Like, statehood is an irreversible condition. Once you're in it, there's no control Z. There's no undo. There's no, oh, we don't like this. So it is a little scary, particularly as an Hispanic country, that we would dissolve ourselves into a country that some would see as a different country. But independence also could be scary, right? In terms of, okay, so we don't have a printing press for our dollar, for our currency. We don't have all that experiencing that in that realm. So therefore, it's a catch-22. We are unsure of what would happen if we stay away from the territorial status, but nobody likes really the territorial status. Therefore, but at the same time, nothing has changed an inch since 6-7 years ago. The Supreme Court of the United States told us that we are still a territory of the United States. People went, you know, the debates sparked up again, but we have not moved an inch. And I don't really see much change in the short term, except some sort of collective declaration that the current situation is untenable, but it's still going on. So it's sort of rarely tenable, because that's been the situation for more than 100 years. So it's a difficult situation because you have to have agreement with amongst ourselves, and then we under all the options, we need someone else across the table. We can negotiate statehood by ourselves, even independence. You can technically do it unilaterally, but that doesn't really work that way. So we need more of what would be the political conditions for a real solution that benefits both sides, right? But anyway, so if you know the answer to that one, you would have solved 125 years of Puerto Rican colonialism. Let me know if you find it.
Very good. And Amilcar, one of the reasons why, you know, this discussion seems so salient is this has become a partisan issue in the U.S., particularly because the progressive wing of the Democratic Party have advocated for statehood. The official position of the Republican Party has been a rejection, but based on partisan issues, that this would just ensure two more Democratic senators and another Democrat in the House. But that kind of papers over much deeper issues about Puerto Rican statehood, doesn't it?
Very quickly, if I go back a century, the very first political parties formed in Puerto Rico after the dawn of U.S. rule advocated statehood and were closely aligned with the Republican Party. If you understand that the Republican Party back then was the party of Lincoln and the Democrats had a huge segregationist wing, it makes sense. But the American political parties have realigned since then. I think that far too many people don't understand, to be candid, what statehood is really all about. Take a peek at the American flag. You see 50 stars, you see 13 stripes. How did you get all those stars? Oh, we carve out a territory. Who moved into those territories? The people from the existing states. So in effect, statehood was a process of reabsorbing Americans who moved west. And when the federal government acquired a territory that was full of different people, statehood was invariably delayed. Why it was delayed in Oklahoma, Arizona, New Mexico, and even Utah. Yes, they were white, mostly Anglo-Saxon, but because they were different in the sense of practicing plural marriage. For Arizona and New Mexico, it was because of a Latino majority. Oklahoma, because of Native Americans. So statehood was always a process of reuniting the same homogeneous mass, not about bringing in new peoples. And this now manifests itself in the contemporary partisan debates in Washington, D.C. Let me be frank. We have now seen the quiet dog whistle racism of the 1970s and 80s become foghorn racism in more recent years. And to be candid, there are folks in one of the two major political parties who, frankly, don't want this wave of brown people, even if they all learn to speak English and become culturally in every way. Just ask Puerto Ricans who've been living on the U.S. mainland for a couple of generations. They're still racialized, and this affects how Washington sees the island of Puerto Rico. It's not so easy, and it's a very uncomfortable conversation.
And Jorge, the Supreme Court had the opportunity to revisit the insular cases. I know there was a case that actually was potentially on their docket and they chose not to. First of all, the insular cases, basically, my understanding, you can correct me on this, basically back when the U.S. takes colonies, asked, if you take territories, does the Constitution follow? And the answer at the time was no. And some of the justification was pretty indefensible at this point, having to do with, could they understand the Constitution? There was, quite frankly, was considerably racist when it came out. Could the court solve a lot of these problems by just revisiting the insular cases and or possibly even just setting it aside? This is a court that sets aside precedent when it chooses to. If you just set aside the precedent of the insular cases and say the Constitution follows in any territory, how much would that resolve a number of the issues that Puerto Rico has raised?
First of all, the issue is much worse. So what happened, so before the insular cases, you just had territories. And by the way, territories are under Section 3, Article 4 of the U.S. Constitution, which is about new states, right? So the historically and structurally, the concept of a territory was as a transition, as a process, which I think Armin can describe beautifully, in terms of eventually granting statehood. Now then you have these populated places that the notion of an automatic transition to statehood became a scary prospect for many powerful interests in the United States. And so in the insular cases, the Supreme Court, what we could say, split the territorial atom and said, wait a minute. So we had that one form of territories of the 50, right? The new 37. But we have unincorporated territories. And those are the ones that need never, ever start the path to statehood. And you can be there indefinitely. Now, the new Supreme Court, if you check the last five cases about Puerto Rico in the last 10 years, that distinction is gone. It's absolutely gone. They only mention territories, but the definition they use is the new one, is the unincorporated territory. Currently, the United States, except from one little inlet in the Pacific, has no incorporated territories, not one. Everybody is an unincorporated territory in the United States, and it's a permanent possibility to stay there. Now, in several of these cases, many of the litigants actually asked directly the U.S. Supreme Court to revisit the insular cases, and explicitly the U.S. Supreme Court has resisted. The only voices that have sort of raised concern were Sonia Sotomayor, who, interestingly enough, is obviously of Puerto Rican descent, and Justice Neil Gorsuch, who wrote a really direct concurring opinion recently. But even he, even though he scolded the insular cases, he himself acknowledged that he has no answer as to what would replace it. And I think that what scares many of the justices in the Supreme Court, that even if they, and that's a big if, even if they really have trouble with the insular cases, well, maybe they don't because it doesn't really affect them, it affects other people. But even if they believe that it's wrongly decided, that it's a shameful, racist-laden opinions with references to alien racist and horrible descriptions of non-white peoples, that they don't know what to replace it with. And therefore, the status quo works better. So therefore, I get they're saying that from the it's they are defending U.S. institutional interests. And if that means keeping the insular cases alive, because they don't know if any change they would do from a court standpoint would compromise the political branches in the designs of Puerto Rico, then so be it. And that's where we are right now.
With that, we'll end this part of the conversation. Our panel today has been Amílcar Antonio Barreto, who is professor and chair of Cultures, Societies, and Global Studies and the interim director of International Affairs and Political Science at Northeastern University. He's the author of American Identity, Congress, and the Puerto Rico Statehood Debate, and The Politics of Language in Puerto Rico Revisited. And Jorge Farinacci Fernos, associate professor of law at the Inter-American University of Puerto Rico Law School and a visiting professor at the University of Buffalo Law School. He's the author of The New Insular Cases and the Territorial Clause, From Temporary Incorporation to Permanent Unincorporation, and the forthcoming Puerto Rico's Constitutional Paradox, Colonial Subordination, Democratic Tension, and the Promise of Progressive Transformation. Thank you both very much for joining us.
When we come back, what are the causes of the ongoing protests and violence in Peru since the removal of its president by the Congress? Stay with us. Thank you. This is the Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. I'm Maria Armudian. Peru is in a political crisis with a battle between its former president and the Congress that removed him from power. How much does it challenge the unity and stability of the South American nation? Doug Becker explores.
I'm Doug Becker. On December 7th, Peru's Congress removed its president, Pedro Castillo, and replaced him with Dina Boluarte. Castillo supporters took to the streets and protested this decision, demanding Castillo's return or a dissolution of Congress and new elections. Now, after over 5 weeks of protest, where as many as 43 people have been killed by security forces, the protests continue. So on today's show, we examine the deep political crisis the South American nation faces and the future of Peruvian democracy. Our panel is Victoria Chinchung, a postdoctoral teaching fellow in the Department of Political Science and International Relations at the University of Southern California. She's the author of Conceptualizing China-Latin American Relations in the 21st Century, The Boom, Bust, and the Aftermath. She co-authored that with Carol Wise, and a comparative view of Chinese relations with Peru in China, Latin America, and the Global Economy with Alvin Kamba. And Jorge Antonio Chavez Manzuelos. He's a lecturer at the Universidad San Ignacio de Loyola in Peru in the International Relations Department and is coordinator of a research group focused on Chinese politics. He's the author of The Chinese Dream of National Rejuvenation and Foreign Policy under Xi Jinping, The Evolution of Chinese Diplomacy from Plainclothed Soldiers to Wolf Warriors. Thank you both very much for joining us on this issue. And this is an issue that I think it's not getting as much coverage, certainly in the Western media, as it deserves. So Victoria Chinchung, first of all, what's going on in Peru? I know there's a political crisis going on, but why are there these protests? And even more importantly, why do they continue?
Thank you for the invitation. So I think when we're talking about the protests and when we're thinking about this political crisis, it's not that it just started last year or it started with Pedro Castillo. It actually comes from way before, right? Because on the one hand, you have a political crisis. On the other hand, you also have a socioeconomic, social crisis. And that comes from decades ago, if not more, because you're talking about a country that on the one hand, even though there was development, there was economic growth for at least the last 20 years, and I'm talking about post-1990s, right after Fujimori and what have you, but you also see it's deep inequality, deep, racism, discrimination, classism. So you can see that those at the very bottom, especially the rural communities, those who are in the provinces, those who are in the small towns, those who are in those remote communities were not actually receiving the benefits that you will usually see. And I guess to provide a little bit more of context, Peru is a highly and extremely centralized country. So everything is in the capital. So you see those that are saying, we were left behind. And president after president, Congress after Congress, I guess politician after politician, there has been a promise, right, that you are not forgotten. And especially with Pedro Castillo, who represented for the first time, he was someone who was from a rural community. He was someone, right, he was not the typical elite, the typical politician who comes into power with that promise. And yet, right, he gets ousted because he tried a coup. And now the conversation is that there is a political crisis because there are basically no strong parties that can create a consensus. There's no strong parties that can actually create, a united front into go and to build the state that the country needs, right? But there's also a socioeconomic crisis, like I said, because people are trying to say, we are tired. We want to have the same benefits. We don't want to be forgotten. And in fact, today, yeah, it started yesterday, and today, they are protesting at the moment, right? It's supposed to be a peaceful protest, but we have people mostly from southern Peru, which is one of the poorest parts of the country, literally moving towards Lima and showing up and telling the politicians, we want to be heard. And of course, the the consensus that they have, right, or at least the common theme right now is number one, Dina Boluarte, who came to take power after Castillo was ousted, right? She is the constitutional president at the moment. So for her to go out to create a constitutional assembly, so they can vote for a new constitution, right? And to basically change Congress. At least that's the commonality. What else is in discussion? What else is there? You have many factions. So there is, this is the best that I can give, and maybe Jorge Antonio can provide a little bit more of context, mm-hmm. as well, since he's in Peru at the moment. But you are not only seeing a political crisis that just was triggered, you are not only seeing anger, right? From Castillo, and I think that that's the disservice of a lot, as you mentioned, the Western media, or at least in the United States, that hasn't been told. It's not simple, because you need to peel the different layers that are really explaining, at least to a certain extent, what is going on at the moment.
Jorge Antonio, Victoria mentioned a couple of things here, kind of want to dig into here. There seems to be a geographical divide. So Lima versus, outside rural versus urban, and that's a fairly consistent cleavage in a number of countries around the world. A socioeconomic divide, she referenced race as well. So in essence, is this a political crisis that was triggered by the fact that the country just has these deep divisions?
I mean, I believe that there are a number of, as Victoria mentioned, and as Jude just mentioned, there are a number of cross-cutting cleavages that are getting into play during this crisis. There are a whole range of structural issues, like, as Victoria mentioned, the lack of political parties, which can serve as an inch between the population and the state. Parties are mostly electoral associations, a very loose federation of independent aspiring politicians who don't have an ideology in common. I mean, they sometimes are in very different sides of the political spectrum. They are part of the same parties running for Congress. And once they get to Congress, they separate and they form different political formations inside. You have also an issue with that democracy is severely discredited in the country. The support for democracy has been reduced consistently over the last years. You also have an structural inequality, a huge gap in terms of development between the coastal regions and especially between Lima vis-a-vis the southern regions of the country, where you have most of the natural resources, where most of the wealth of the country comes from, I mean, in terms of resources, yet these areas have been neglected. I mean, there has been a process of decentralization, which means that there are local and regional governments who are in charge of large swaths of this budget, but they have issues in terms of formulating projects in implementing initiatives which could improve the quality of life. So the citizens are resenting this, and they are not dividing the responsibility between the central government, which has been traditionally in charge of these funds and the capacity to execute the funds, and the responsibility at the local and regional levels. So that's also part of the equation.
Now, Victoria, you had made a reference to the political crisis itself, and I really want to, drill down on this. What actually compels Congress to remove Castillo was his attempt to dissolve Congress, right? That he was facing, was this his third impeachment procedures? And in each case, he was accused of corruption, if I remember correctly. So, I mean, Castillo was acting undemocratically and then saw himself get removed, that then triggers these crises. Do I have that right? Am I missing something here?
No, actually, that's fairly correct. Right? I mean, if you looked at it from number one, I guess the best way to put it, his days were marked even before he started the presidency, because it was a very contentious election, right? You have him coming, and to be honest, because there were two rounds. people did not expect him to get to where he was, to become the top two candidate. The other one was Keiko Fujimori. So first round, nobody gets more than 50%, right? And we go in second round in voting. But even going second round in voting, he won by a very, very, very marginal amount. So, and again, part of the conversation was, let's not forget, I mean, he's the first fully leftist president as well. So there was a lot of the conversation, again, like the fear of the left, that what it would mean, whether it was would be extreme. And then you had those from the right, center right, et cetera. So there was already that division, and in Congress in itself as well. And I mean, to be told, he did have a lot of investigations, I think about 6 or 7, I don't remember, about cases of corruption. So in a way, there were already things happening in the background, right? So in those attempts of corruption, in those attempts of investigations and what have you, Congress investigates and tries to impeach him once, tries to impeach him the second time. And by the third time, which is the one that actually took him out, that's when he decides and he comes into it. That was what happened in December. He comes out, right, to say that he's going to dissolve Congress. He is going to try, and this is part of the other message that he gave, right? Because most people focus just on the first part where he says, all right, I'm going to dissolve Congress. But he says, I'm going to dissolve Congress. We're going to try to get new elections and what have you. But that's unconstitutional. So basically, he went against the Constitution. So by law, by our Constitution, as imperfect as it could be, right, that's what literally gave Congress, I guess, the advantage, right, of saying, or the opportunity, not the advantage, the opportunity of saying, all right, no, you are out. And that's what has created, the political crisis that we're having right now. Of course, then you have to peel again the other layers. He was someone, right, that even though he won by a very marginal amount, he did come with that promise that those who were not hurt, those cleavages like Jorge Antonio was talking about, right, center versus the rest, the capital versus the provinces, the rich versus the poor, the rural versus the urban. And it's not just those black or white, but you also have these shades of gray where people are saying, well, rather I would say those who were forgotten by the state, right? He represented that. And then when you have him ousted, and then you have his vice president, who is actually Dina Boluarte, who by constitution, right, she becomes the president. But the problem is that because she came initially with the same platform as Castillo, and then later on, she has to conciliate. Not only that, her first mistake, at least in my opinion, please correct me, Jorge Antonio, we disagree. I think it's good to have that conversation too, right? At least to me, her mistake was saying, all right, I'm going to try to complete Castillo's presidency. That means 2026, instead of calling for new elections. And that's when, I guess, the ire of people, particularly from those, again, who were forgotten by the state, they are seeing the crisis going on. They are seeing, you know, their candidate being taken out. That's when it starts triggering even more protests and, of course, the disagreements. I know that I'm like over-explaining maybe, and this is the issue with academics, but I wanted to give a little bit more context too, because I think that it's important to understand a little bit of those factors that did play a role in fueling the rage that we're seeing right now more than anything else.
And you're listening to Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. I'm Doug Becker. We're discussing the ongoing political crisis, protests, political violence in Peru with Victoria Chan-Ching of the University of Southern California and Jorge Antonio Chavez Mazuelos from Universidad San Ignacio de Loyola in Peru. Jorge Antonio, then what Victoria just highlighted here, first of all, we've had several shows on other cases of the so-called pink wave across Latin America. Is this the right's political reaction against the left, the pink wave? Is this better seen in a broader sort of regional context where we're seeing these kinds of reactions against the election of leftists? Or is this much more uniquely Peruvian, and we probably should be wary of making it sound too much like neighboring countries that have faced some of these same sorts of challenges?
I mean, I think there are a whole range of factors which are common, right? I mean, for instance, when Pedro Castillo was was elected in the second ballot, I mean, as Victoria mentioned, by a very small margin. I mean, I think it was less than 50,000 votes, but the bottom line is that he won. There were this right and far right political movements, which basically said there, fraud was committed. And you have had a number of instances of this across the region. I mean, recently in Brazil, you even have had it to some extent in the United States. So the fact of delegitimizing the opponent is not something typically Peruvian. But I think that what adds more content to the current situation is that Castillo was not regarded by certain elites as legitimate by virtue of his origins, right? Because he was basically the son of peasants, because he was not really a person who went to a private university in Lima, who was from a rural area, who was the leader of a union, who wasn't seen as really structured and fit for the role. And at the same time, he was seen as the candidate of a Marxist-Leninist party. And this is something that I think the audience should know. I mean, Marxism and Leninism and Maoism have a very different connotation here, because a lot of people associate this ideology with terrorism. They make a sort of immediate equivalence, right? I mean, terrorism can be used by people with different ideological backgrounds, from right or from left wing, from religious, but some people are equating the very notion of left or Marxism immediately with terrorism. So he was labeled to some extent as a sort of a representative of terrorists. And that is the same thing you're seeing now in the protests. I mean, the word you use for legitimizing the protesters is that they are terrorists. You label them as a security threat that needs to be eliminated. And a security threat that doesn't really have agency. I mean, they are manipulated by other terrorism and by the Bolivians and by illegal economies. But yet they are a threat that needs to be eliminated. So it's a way of delegitimizing the agency of the others, delegitimizing them as political actors. And at the same time, something even worse is dehumanizing. Because if they are a threat, if they are securitized, then if I need to eliminate them, if I need to fire at them, then it's not wrong. And I think that's a big part of the problem. And this doesn't just come after Castillo tried to commit this coup, which failed because he didn't have any support to carry out this coup. I mean, there were some of these discourses being used even before, and that is very dangerous. I think that is one of the worst parts.
Yeah, and to follow that up quickly, I mean, the Peruvian context here then is it's not just broadly terrorist. I know the Colombians will associate anybody the least bit to the left of the political spectrum with Venezuela and with Castro. But with Peru, you've got this specific historic context of terrorism with groups like Sendero Luminoso, the Shining Path, that so many Peruvians remember that period. And that obviously was one of the great challenges of attempting to democratize, became this justification for right-wing authoritarian politics. Jorge Antonio, I'll ask you first, and is any of that playing out in this discourse? Kind of a remember Shining Path, and if we, you know, support Castillo, we're back to that period.
Yes, I mean, actually, and that is exactly the kind of discourse that you're eliciting from some people who are against the protests. I mean, for instance, yesterday, a large number of protesters were hosted at two very big public universities, probably the most important public universities in the country, the National University of Engineering and the Universidad Mayor de San Marcos. And, I mean, people were saying, you cannot host them there because this is public property. This is property of the state. And these guys are terrorists. And we are remembering that there were terrorists who were studying at these universities in the 80s. So, but I think that is a way of oversimplifying reality and delegitimizing those you don't agree with politically. And that is very, very dangerous. And we are seeing that, unfortunately. So I believe that it's very unfortunate to securitize protests. We might not agree with certain elements. We might not think that a constitutional assembly is the best way to go. We might not agree with the fact that Pedro Castillo should be freed because breached the constitution. I mean, and there are, I mean, the attorney general said that he might have committed the crime of rebellion and else. We might not, we might believe that Dina Boluarte as a president is a legal president and constitutional president, but there are people who see the other way around, who see things the other way around and believe that Dina Boluarte lacks of legitimacy, that Pedro Castillo was actually a representative of the oppressed who was unduly ousted by an elite. And even if we don't agree with that, we need to understand that thinking that way is also legitimate. We shouldn't label them as terrorists. I think that is a big part of the problem. And to some extent, it conditions the response of the government. I mean, there are certain far-right movements who say the government should be much more vocal and much more aggressive against these people. And I think that is highly problematic because we are not listening to what the others are trying to.
Yeah, and Victoria, you will respond as well.
I wanted to actually highlight the last part that Jorge Antonio was saying, right? I think that one of the issues was that particularly the far right and the more conservative factions, what has happened, they have been dehumanizing the protesters and dehumanizing the legitimate call for the opportunity, I guess, right, to have the state to help them, to help the state to provide. Because think about this, you are talking about population that does not have access to water, does not have access to sanitation, all the very important services they have been waiting for years and years. On the other hand, you also have this very same population, whether influenced by their beliefs, whether influenced by I don't know, politicians, whatever the case, that are calling for some changes. And then some of these changes are very conservative. In some cases, and I think one of the calls for changing the constitution was that you should bring back the death penalty. So you are also talking about losing certain rights, right? Because of that extremism, that factionalism that is existing. So, and Jorge Antonio brought it up earlier, and we talked about it earlier, we don't have a strong ideology. Like when you think about Peru at the moment, when you think about the different parties, we could talk about a certain kind of left, but there are many lefts, right? We even have the so-called caviares, which basically means like people who are very well off and who somehow have some leftist ideas. We also have the extreme right, the center right. So they start like that, but at the end of the day, it really becomes this, I guess, pursuit of political interest rather than actually becoming a party, actually, I guess, trying to find consensus, trying to talk to each other. There's no such thing. I think that at the moment it's more reactionary. I mean, I could be wrong in that sense, but at least the way I'm seeing it, a lot of the conversation, a lot of the conversation, reactions, actions, whatnot, is more reactive versus actually sitting down and say, okay, what is it that we actually need as a country? Not individually, not because of the party, but as a country, what is it that we need? And it's really hard to reach out because, again, you have the politicians, you have the private sector, you have the public sector, and you have this population, right, that has been suffering. And again, I think that one of the mistakes right now by the conservative right and even by part of the government or even some people in the capital, right, is dehumanizing them. And equating them, right, as Jorge Antonio said, they are terrorists. Yes, there is the association to a certain extent. They might be groups. I don't know. I haven't been asking every single, you know, protester, who are you or where you come from. But that's the issue that is also fueling, again, the anger, right, and the frustration more than anything else.
That's it. Problem with polarization. We've got about 3 minutes left. Jorge Antonio, Victoria said maybe President Boluarte's biggest mistake might have been saying that she would complete the term rather than just holding an election. Is that the way out of this political crisis, is calling for a new election in the hope that, I mean, it would probably increase the heat a bit if there's an election, but at least would resolve the big broad issue as to what is the population support?
It's the solution of a firefighter, right? We have a fire. We need to make sure that we get rid of it. But of course, this will not solve the structural causes behind the crisis, but at least it might reduce the violence. I agree with Victoria. I think that was a gross mistake. I think that she should have come to the Congress to swear as president, but say, you know what, we should call for elections as soon as possible. It is in your hands, Congress. I mean, I cannot decide this by myself. The only way in which I could put pressure or to ensure that elections will be called immediately is if I resign. But I have that leverage over you. But let's do it next year, right? Let's not wait for 2013. The country cannot hold that long. I think that was certainly a mistake. I think that was a misstatement of the political situation of the country and was certainly wrong. I don't think that is the solution to all the problems. That might be a start. But yeah, there are certainly a whole range of reforms that will need to be implemented in the political, the legal, and the constitutional system of the country. But I don't think this Congress is in a position to carry out those reforms because the lack of political legitimacy to advance that agenda.
Our guests today have been Victoria Chin-Chung. She is a postdoctoral teaching fellow in the Department of Political Science and International Relations at the University of Southern California. She's the author of Conceptualizing China-Latin America Relations in the 21st Century, The Boom, the Bust, and the Aftermath with Carol Weiss, and A Comparative View of Chinese Relations with Peru in the book China, Latin America, and the Global Economy with Alvin Kamba, and Jorge Antonio Chavez Mazuelos. He is a lecturer at the Universidad San Ignacio de Loyola in Peru in the International Relations Department and is coordinator of a research group focused on Chinese politics. He is author of The Chinese Dream of National Rejuvenation and Foreign Policy under Xi Jinping and The Evolution of Chinese Diplomacy from Plainclothes Soldiers to Wolf Warriors. Thank you both very much for sharing your insights.
And that's it for today's program. Thank you for listening. The Scholar Circle is hosted by Doug Becker. Its managing producers are Ankina Agassian and Melissa Chiprin. Seb Dongre is our webmaster and assistant producer. Our archives are at scholarcircle.org, and our podcasts are on Apple and Google Podcasts and iTunes. Please follow us on @ScholarCircle or me @Armudian and join our Facebook page. I'm the founder, anchor, and occasional host, Maria Armudian.